Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. The bad actors of the insect world have received lots of attention in recent years. The emerald ash borer, which decimates trees. The mosquito, with a bite that itches and may cause illness. And let's not forget the tick. Although technically not an insect, it's a close relative and can transmit diseases like Lyme and brucellosis. All in all, it's a creepy crowd, but our guest today says, let us not forget the good guys, those insects pollinating our plants, processing our compost, killing the bad bugs, or at least keeping their populations from taking over. We're talking beneficial bugs this hour in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guest is Alan Eaton, Extension Professor at UNH Cooperative Extension, Integrated Pest Management Specialist. Alan has just published a paper highlighting beneficial insects with lots of photos, by the way. There's a link to it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Alan, nice to see you and nice to not talk about ticks today. That's what we usually end up talking about.
And you're exactly right. It's good to talk about the beneficial things. I've been the harbinger of doom and gloom all spring. So now we'll talk about something good.
Well, you say in your paper that although there's lots of information about insect pests, there's not that much on beneficial insects. And I just wonder why you think that's the case, Alan.
Well, there's a number of reasons. Probably one of them is that most insects and many insect families and groups don't have common names. So whereas many of the pests do have common names, and what drives us to give something a common name is if they become of economic importance to us, and usually that's the pests. So as a result, there's a problem. If we speak Latin names all the time, that's a bit of difficulty. Also, distinguishing them is a bit tricky. And to really describe the situation and understand them requires both reading verbiage and looking at illustrations. And so I wanted to do something like this for years and years, but realized that it would be just prohibitively expensive to do it in color, which is the way you need it. So it wasn't until the advent, until our shifting over and producing publications by posting them to the web that gave me this opportunity. So this is a 23 or 24 page publication with 70 something photos of mine. So
yeah.
We never could have done it earlier.
Well, and it's not long and it's easy to understand. Why do you think it's so important that people understand that these creatures are also out there doing a lot of work?
I think there's a tremendous amount of press that's given to the pests, and actually the ones that are not pests far outnumber the ones that are. And the ones that we can demonstrate are beneficials alone, those certainly outnumber the pest species that we've got. So it makes sense to understand them. Also, we're so quick on the trigger with a pesticide sprayer or something like that to relieve a problem. It's been a continuing problem I've had both when I was a graduate student and here at UNH when people come to me asking for problems. What do I spray for this pest? Sometimes it's something as simple as a mayfly sitting on your tomato plant, but you sprayed it. Well, they didn't know it wasn't a pest. It just happened to be sitting there. So we run across these situations all the time. And part of my idea was to try to work to reduce our overdependence on use of insecticides. That's part of what integrated pest management is all about. And part of it is to just encourage a greater understanding and appreciation for what we've got here. We're just surrounded by these things, and they're fascinating.
Well, they are. So much attention on the bad actors, Alan, that we automatically focus on that and we say, what can I spray to get rid of these terrible, you know, pests on my plants or in my house? And you're saying if the focus was a little more balanced, we wouldn't maybe automatically jump to use the chemicals, which have all sorts of other harmful impacts.
And not only that, but there's a lot of people who are watching birds and have been for years. And increasingly, when publications became available, some of those started watching dragonflies and identifying dragonflies because they're colorful and easy to identify, like this one right here, the calico pennant. And as more and more of these kinds of things become available, maybe more of us will be saying, oh, wow, I saw a halicted bee the other day, or I saw a megachilid or something. We're surrounded by all these little things that are going on, having incredible dramas, but they're so tiny, we don't pay attention.
So just like people go on bird watching tours and they take pictures and they have lists of what they've seen and so forth, you're hoping that people might actually go on bug watching tours.
Maybe not, but at least have a greater appreciation, right, rather than just something to be sprayed.
Well, and as people are concerned about birds, if birds are picking up pesticides, you know, from the bugs that they eat or whatever, that's not good for them.
That's true.
Let's take a call, Alan, then we've got so much more to talk about with this. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Now, here in the exchange, we've done tons of shows about ticks and mosquitoes and other problematic actors of the insect world. But this hour, we're focusing on the beneficial bugs all around us. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your comments and questions on what you've seen. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, lots of pictures on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, and a link to Alan's study there. And Alan, let's go to Laconia first, and Tina is on the air. Hi, Tina. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for taking my call. This is a great, great topic. I'm an organic gardener and have found the past 2 years I have had a cucumber beetle and squash bug problem. Aside from picking them off my plants continually, what beneficial insects would you recommend to combat that?
Thank you so much for the call, Tina. I really appreciate it. And you talk about this, Alan, in the book.
Actually, I'm suspicious that Tina was a plant because it's the very first photo on the first page of the publication. Remember that fly that has the black wings and the orangey-red markings? It's called the feather-legged fly. It's actually a parasite of squash bug, which is one of the ones she mentions. And it's not commercially available, but it is here to attack them if you just don't go overboard by spraying this, that, and the other. Actually, I find more of those in organic farms than I do elsewhere. And
the good flies.
Yes. And what I would tend to recommend in her situation is more use of physical controls like netting to cover the squash and so forth, rather than look for a biological control that will knock the numbers down so low that the pest will be at acceptable levels for you. So in that particular case with the stripers and squash bugs, there's a couple of things that will help out, but not commercially available. Just organic growers usually aren't going crazy spraying stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like Tina wants to do that because she's an organic grower. So netting would be a possibility. You know, I'm trying to think if there's anything grosser than those big, fat caterpillars that get on your tomatoes. Were they hornworms? Is
yes.
That what they are? And there's a picture of them in your publication. They are just disgusting and they eat your wonderful tomatoes. And you say in your publication, you don't need to spray for these. They're a beneficial insects that will go after these for you.
Yeah, and in fact, for you give the hornworm example, about this time of year, I'll commence applying BT, a biological insecticide, on my tomatoes to protect the hornworms. I look for protect against the hornworms because I look for that damage. And when I start seeing it, then I'll apply it, and not before then. But at the same time, if I find any of the hornworms on my plants that have been parasitized, I pick them off and then pitch them as far as I can go so that they'll survive and the parasites will survive, but they'll go eat something else and they won't be feeding on my tomatoes.
Well, a couple of definitions, Alan, if we could, before we dive into some of the specifics in this paper. The word pest versus beneficial insect. How subjective is that?
Very subjective. Anthropocentric, some people would say, because we, of course, are defining that the pest is something that harms, something that's of value to us.
Right. So let's just clear that up right away.
So it's a really anthropocentric term. If Gaia, the mother goddess of the earth, were interviewed by the New York Times and were asked, what's the biggest earth pest? It's clear she would say, well, those pesky human beings are the biggest earth pests. So to us, a pest is something that harms things that are of value to us, and that could be things that we produce, but it could also be contentment. I'm sitting here trying to read a book, and instead mosquitoes are buzzing all over the place and bothering me and black flies flying in my face. So it could be biting. It could be annoyance. It could be affecting something that's of aesthetic value to us. It could be making holes in our house like the termites that might threaten it. So that any of these various things could be considered pests, and they could be insects, they could be pathogens, they could be weeds, there's any number of things. And understanding our definition of pest and then understanding what we do about it is part of examining more closely how then we react. If something is a pest that's of serious enough consequences that we may want to do something about it, then that opens the avenue for various options. Amongst them are spraying of pesticides, some of which are chemical, some of which aren't. But it's important, I think, to look at them and see how serious they are, and that sort of judges what level of action you may need to take.
And a little bit later we'll talk about, you know, what other actions you can take besides spraying chemicals, since we all know that that has its own problems.
And that's why we call it pest management. In the old days, we talked about pest control. When I took my first entomology course, it was about controlling those pests. And now we talk about pest management, understanding how to manipulate the populations and use all the tools available to us, and understanding how to measure how damaging they are, because some are really serious and some are much less serious and warrant much less attention.
That's really interesting, that sort of mind shift from pest control to pest management.
There we go.
Again, the number for you to join us, like Tina did. And Tina, thank you for that call. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, more on bugs that help, that we humans see as beneficial. 1-800-892-6477. What bad actors or good actors of the insect world have caught your attention? Or is there an insect that you've always wondered about? 1-800-892-6477, again, is our number. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. One more question for you, Alan, about this idea of pest versus beneficial insect. And you said, you know, our definition of pest is definitely based on humans, whether we're annoyed, whether our health is threatened, whether something we care about is threatened by this. Could a pest be beneficial, according to your viewpoint? I mean, could, you know, mosquitoes be seen as incredibly beneficial because they feed fish and birds, for example?
Yes, we have some examples of critters that are in that situation, and maybe a pest as an immature and beneficial as an adult, or vice versa. In some cases, the abundance, to some people, the appearance of lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of insects is a problem. So when we use parasites or predators to predaceous insects to control other insects. To some people, that's unacceptable. Back when we had gypsy moth outbreaks, and the last big outbreak that I can remember might have been around 1981 or so. I'm trying to remember way back. We had little calcitid wasps that were attacking them, and they were all over the place in my house and all my neighbors' houses. Inside, both.
Oh, yikes.
They're so very tiny because there were huge numbers of gypsy moths. We had 2 million acres of our state defoliated that year.
I remember that.
And the cure was getting objectionable to many people. So there was something that's the good bug that's attacking this bad bug, but to many people it was getting objectionable.
Biocontrol itself was becoming like a pest.
We have that situation in greenhouses sometimes where we have growers who control pests using imported predators or parasitoids. And then they have to put up signs warning their customers that, oh, yes, you might happen to see some insects on these, but look at these photos right here. These are the beneficial insects. They're not going to harm your plants. Don't reject this plant if it has a bug on it. It may actually be a beneficial one.
And that's why this publication is so important then, Alan, you're saying. In general, our first reaction is, oh,
what is it?
This
and how
bug
do I
my
kill
plant.
It? Yeah.
Right. And in fact, it might be protecting your plant or whatever from something else.
Yes, exactly.
You're getting into the history of biocontrol, which is really interesting. Again, the use of good bug to topple a bad bug. Just quickly finish up that gypsy moth story. So what happened? There was a good bug brought in basically to combat the gypsy moths, and they started to proliferate, and then what?
Gypsy moths were introduced to this country around early 1860s, and beginning in the late 1800s, and through the 1920s or 30s, there were major efforts to try to locate and introduce parasites and predators and pathogens to control them. The early work, since the science was early, it was young, wasn't quite as successful.
The science of biocontrol.
Eventually, a fungus was introduced that tipped the balance, and it has been keeping it under control since, except when we have drought years. So there are some places where we're seeing built up of the last couple of years. But there were many other parasitoids and a few predators that were imported that helped to lower it. It's an example of something where we had partial success for many years. Here in the state, we have other examples of biocontrol that have been tremendous successes. And they don't get as much attention, I think, as they deserve.
Well, and it's sort of, it seems like a scary concept in a way. You know, you don't want to have your biocontrol go overboard. What if the introduced new bug turns out not to work, and then you've got two bad bugs on your hands? So you can see why people get nervous about this.
Yeah, and of course, the science of biological control, especially the classical biological control, where you search in a foreign country for parasitoids or predators that might attack the pests of interest to you, that is a very exact it's a much different science than it was when it was first introduced, and the rules and the regulations to get permission to introduce now something are now much more rigid. They didn't exist earlier. And so as a result, there's a very careful review of these kinds of things before things are allowed to be brought in. And that's why in recent years, in recent decades, there have been many more successes than there were early on, and there's relatively few failures, and there haven't been any that I'm aware of spectacular problems in recent years.
Well, maybe after a short break, Alan, you can give us a couple examples of those many, many successes that you talk about. And we'll go back to our listeners as well. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, more on bugs that help. And to see some cool photos of some of the insects that Alan's talking about, you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. There's some photos there and a link to the publication. Again, nhpr.org/exchange. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
A young man and woman fall in love while traveling across Europe in Joseph Monninger's new novel, but he says making that seem interesting on the page is not that easy.
Being in love isn't really that interesting. It's the before and after that really kind of brings the impact.
I'm Peter Biello. Joseph Monninger and I speak about his new book and writing about love on The Bookshelf from NHPR. Find this and all of NHPR's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what's that bug? Hold off swatting or spraying. It might be helpful to gardeners, farmers, woods, and wildlife. What insects have you seen that you think could be beneficial? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Also, if you'd like to see some photos of some of the beneficial insects we're talking about, you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Alan Eaton, let's go right back to our listeners. And Bob is in Guilford. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you so much for having this guy on. And we love your show.
Good. Go ahead, Bob.
I have a question about Japanese beetles. I have a small vineyard, a neighbor and myself, and we just haven't seen them this year. And it's unusual. They don't show up around 4th of July. So I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
And are Japanese beetles, pardon my lack of knowledge, Bob, are Japanese beetles bad for vineyards?
Well, last year we had just a bumper crop of grapes. It was just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And, you know, they pretty much defoliate the plants. So I didn't want to use any kind of, any kind of pesticides or insecticide, but I don't know. This year, we must be living right or something because they haven't shown up.
Wow. Okay. Well, very interesting to hear from you, given, his extreme interest in this topic. He's got a vineyard and would like to see it succeed.
And Bob is right. In fact, one of the things I did this morning before I came in was I checked my own grapes and other things saying, my gosh, what's going on here? It's July 12th, and I haven't seen a single Japanese beetle yet. It used to be that they would be, the first adults would be about the 30th of June, and by now we'd have them all over the place. And I'm guessing that although there is a parasitoid that attacks it and lays eggs on it, and I have photos of it in the publication, and I got something on the desk here as well, I think actually the situation with that one is that the last couple of years of drought, I think, have knocked it down, and survival has been relatively poor. And so as a result, the Japanese beetle numbers have been low the last 2 years, and maybe this is going to be the third year in a row. Perhaps this will be a trend. I don't know. But it's possible that some of the natural agents may be involved, but I suspect it is the drought. You're up in the northern edge where the drought wasn't quite as severe. So let's hope it continues that way. I'm going to speak at a meeting tonight up in Grafton County, and we're going to check the same thing up there.
Interesting. Well, thank you for the call, Bob. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So most gardeners and farmers like Bob, can't stand Japanese beetles. Here's the picture of the Japanese beetle. You can see it on our website again. It's got two, pardon my lack of pronunciation,
tachinid eggs.
It's got two tachinid eggs on it. These are parasite insects, basically.
Yeah, big oval whitish marks on the top of the body, and they don't belong there. And you look at it and say, wow, what's that? Well, that's a sign that the parasitoid has attacked that one, and that one is doomed.
Well, and I want to let everybody know, in this picture, you got the Japanese beetle. It has these two little white spots on it, and Alan's title is This Japanese Beetle Has Two Tachinid Eggs and Will Die Soon. Speaking as just an average person, Alan, I don't think I would look closely enough. I would say, oh, Japanese beetle, get off my flowers, squish. So, it's hard to see that beetle munching on your basil or whatever and take the time to see that, it also has a parasite attached to it. It's
and when
doomed.
When you look closely, and that's one of the reasons for publishing these photos, you look closely, you begin to appreciate what's going to be happening. in the movie Alien, they have this scene where they're all sitting there eating lunch or something, and suddenly one of them goes, "Oh, I don't feel so good." And then scary music starts, and boom, out of a stomach bursts the big parasite. Well, the same thing happens without the scary music. In this particular case, the thing attacked it and was living inside its body and eventually will kill it. So these things are all around us. Maybe.
Well, and how hard is it in general, though, to recognize that, you know, that icky bug that's, again, eating your basil or your flowers is actually doomed, that it does have some sort of a parasite on it? And don't spray. Let the parasite do its work.
For the tachinids, it's easy. And in fact, in my hand now is a photo that came in yesterday to me from one of my colleagues. Elena was looking at cornfields somewhere in Stratford County, and she found a bunch of armyworms. And on this photo, there's there's five eggs visible, the white spots where they don't belong. They're asymmetric, and they're tachinid eggs. And partly because the parasitism rate was so high, she recommended to that particular grower, don't spray there. The parasites are going to knock these back. And so a little attention, sometimes it just takes a little attention to something like this, and you'll recognize something you never would have thought of.
It's really interesting. So just, you know, maybe a little attention and a magnifying glass so that you can see what's going on, and you might just be problem solved.
Whole world appears that you didn't appreciate earlier.
Well, and again, we've talked a lot about photos, and I want to invite folks to go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can sort of look and listen at the same time. Alan's publication is there, along with a couple other pictures that we posted. The number for you to join us right now is 1-800-892-6477. David's in Alexandria. Hi, David. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi, David, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, quick question. I'm an organic farmer, and I've worked on some farms that have used stuff like BT, biological insecticides, you know, USDA certified organic stuff. And my question is, what are the implications for that, even though it's, you know, okay for organic growers to use that? Are those insecticides going to be killing the beneficial insects that we need to balance out our farms and gardens?
Right. Thanks for the call, David. Go ahead, Alan.
David's used the term BT. It's shorthand for Bacillus thuringiensis. It's the active ingredient in some caterpillar killing insecticides. So they're very, very specific, with a very specific mode of action. They kill only caterpillars and almost no other form of life. And they only do it when caterpillars eat them. So if you spray it on your plants, then any caterpillars that consume it will die as a result. And so that means it could be that there are some that are not particularly serious pests that you might knock off. So you control that by putting the spray where you want it. But one of the reasons it's such a workhorse for us for caterpillar control is that it has almost zero negative effects on other insects, so that we can spray it for caterpillars and it won't harm the flies, the bees, the bugs, the other things that are out there nearby. It's a very specific tool. And again, use it if you really need it and don't put it on when you don't.
Well, people listening may be wondering, okay, so Alan's talking about all these beneficial insects, you know, parasite insects, predator insects that sort of go after the bad guys, so to speak. But you don't recommend that people go somewhere and buy these, Alan, and dump them in their gardens.
Usually not outdoors. If you're in an indoor situation, yes. But buying them outdoors and then intending to release them outdoors is usually not a successful route. Occasionally, we have one area where it can work, in the area of filth flies. But generally, if you buy these online or wherever from your local, wherever you get to have a supplier, you've got to be able to match it to the conditions that you've got. And most people don't have the technical know-how to do that. And then the major problem is you release them, and what do? They
fly
disperse.
Away.
They fly away. Whereas if you do it in a greenhouse, they can't get out.
Right.
And so they may fly back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth for several days and then settle down and then start attacking things. So in a greenhouse or another enclosure where you're restricting them, it can be helpful. But outdoors, no. I'd rather see people encourage the naturally occurring ones and let them deal with it rather than try to import. When we do biocontrol projects, such as we alluded to earlier, typically they're long-term projects that have incorporated a tremendous amount of scientific study, and after a lot of study, they've brought in this new species or that new species that never occurred in North America or wherever you are before. And that's left for the experts, and it takes years, but the results can be spectacularly successful.
Let's take another call. This is Michelle in Henniker. Go ahead, Michelle. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Listen, my question and comment is about wasps. A couple years ago, I was looking up, like, what was the purpose of wasps and ticks? And, well, I didn't care that ticks served any purpose because they can't stand them. They live up in the woods in New Hampshire. I was wondering about the wasps. And so I kind of Googled the benefits of wasps. And it turns out they do have a lot of them. Well, I hate them in my house and boring into the eaves of my house and creating nests and stuff like that. It turns out that wasps have a lot of gardening benefits, and I was wondering if maybe we could talk about them.
Well, I really appreciate the call, Michelle, because I also have an email here from Steve in Nashua who says, several years ago, my wife and I were horrified to see hundreds of wasps digging holes in the dirt next to our driveway. When I searched online to find a way to kill them, I discovered they were sand wasps, quote, good bugs that aren't aggressive and actually feed on mosquitoes. Steve says they moved on after a year or two. I wish they'd come back. So, Michelle, thanks for the call and Steve for the email. And go ahead, Alan.
We're sort of
bred to be afraid of wasps.
And we use the term wasp actually to refer to many, many different families of Hymenoptera. So the Braconids and Ichneumons, which are parasites, are called wasps. But I suspect Michelle refers to the Vespids, the stinging wasps and hornets, things like that. New Hampshire is blessed with, let's see, is it 9 or was it 11 species of yellow jackets? And so although they can make their point, if you give us an argument about whose land this is, they also have beneficial roles. One of them is that they are valuable predators searching for caterpillars and sawflies, and they find them and prey on them and bring them back to their nests. So there's one role. They also, to some degree, will feed on carrion and eliminate that, although there are some better carrion feeders.
Carrion's roadkill, basically.
The role as caterpillar hunters and sawfly hunters is significant and often overlooked. And so in my yard, when I see these big bald-faced hornet nests and so forth on the house, if they're far enough away from a door or high up where they're not going to be disturbing me, I leave them alone. If they're right next to the doorway where I or somebody else might get stung, then I eliminate them. And that's the way I get my balance about tolerating them. With respect to yellow jackets, most of our species are ground nesters, and I do the same thing. If it's in a place where I might walk nearby, I eliminate that nest. But otherwise, I try to tolerate them because I recognize that they're important predators of caterpillars and sawflies.
Well, and anything that kills mosquitoes is okay with me. You know, up until, gosh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, Alan, I didn't even realize that wasps and hornets might nest in the ground, because you always think of that, you know, sort of classic nest in the corner of your
yes.
house or barn somewhere. But then there was an unfortunate incident at a summer camp where, you know, some child stepped on a whole nest and all the hornets or wasps or whatever they were came flying out. And of course, you have a crowd of children running and screaming. But before that, I didn't even realize they were in the ground.
And of course, the ground nests are a little bit more difficult to spot. You need a little experience to find them and know what to look for. But they're out there, and mid and late summer and early fall are the times when we have the most problems with them.
You know, just real quickly, you mentioned the benefits of wasps, not just in terms of, you know, going after the bad bugs, so to speak, but also feeding on carrion. That means roadkill, right? Basically,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And that's another broad benefit that you briefly touch on in this paper. Just remind us on a broader scale how insects help us out in all kinds of ways.
Well, of course, insects have important roles in the natural environment in recycling and reprocessing materials. So there's a number of species, in addition to some microorganisms, that are very important in breakdown of dead plant material, leaf litter, and so forth. There's uncounted millions of Calambula and springtails and other things that have a job breaking down leaf litter. If they were not here to do this, we'd knee deep in leaves, and their role is to recycle these things, get them back into the soil, and so forth. The same is true of some other things: dead bodies lying around, dead cow, dead deer, or something like that. There are maggots and a lot of things that are pretty disgusting to us, but if they weren't there to help process those and get rid of those, along with the vultures and other things, then we could be knee-deep in carrion before too long. They also play important roles in feeding in feeding many kinds of animals. There's many kinds of birds, many of the warblers, vireos, and a lot of others, largely swallows and so forth, largely feed on insects. Many fish, the brook trout I caught earlier this year on a fly I tied myself, tends to be an insect specialist, of feeding on insects that are either in the stream or terrestrials that fall into the stream. So these are important roles that we don't want to overlook. Their importance beyond us. We're not the main focus all the time. And they have important roles to fulfill these duties in breaking down and recycling materials and feeding species and helping keep things going. And we shouldn't overlook that. I want people to stand back from having humans at the center of everything for a little bit and think about the rest of it.
Well, and what would the world be like without birds and fish and frogs and all the other creatures that feed on insects? So it kind of sounds like they're the planet's great recyclers.
And in fact,
the maids, in a way, they clean up our junk.
And that's one of the reasons that there's so many species. I'm frequently asked how many species of insects there are in New Hampshire, and nobody really knows, but we assume that there's something on the order of 20,000 species. And most of them don't have common names. And one of the reasons is there's just so many. There's not enough entomologists to work on them all.
Full employment for entomology.
Yes.
Well, and you mentioned a couple times, and I did want to follow up, Alan. You said here in New Hampshire, we've had many, many spectacular successes with biocontrol. So just give us your favorite example, please.
One of the favorite examples I have is done by my colleagues, Pira Siegert and her staff at the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets and Food. Some biocontrol work done a few years back, I think it was the 80s, involving purple loosestrife. A wetland plant that is not native to the U.S. It was brought over from Europe in the post-colonial period, and it came to dominate wetlands.
It's pretty, but it can choke out the native plants.
It chokes up natives, and a lot of species haven't evolved to use it. And so as a result, they were looking for ways to control this. There are a couple of species of beetles, a couple of leaf beetles that were studied and found that they would eat the loosestrife and not other things. And they worked in a couple of locations. One in particular that was a spectacular success was in the Nashua area. And they almost completely eliminated the thing, got it down to a low level with no use of physical controls or herbicides at all. And it stays that way to this day.
Well, coming up, more on beneficial bugs in New Hampshire. And to see photos of some of the insects profiled this hour, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We'll also talk after a short break more about pollinators, because there's a lot of worry about bees and other pollinators these days. So that's coming up as well. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, beneficial bugs. That's our topic this hour, given all the attention that the bad actors of the insect world get. from mosquitoes to ticks to emerald ash borers. We're taking a look at some of the white hats in this story, those bugs that help humanity tremendously in many ways, as we're learning. Our guest is Alan Eaton, Extension Professor at UNH, Cooperative Extension, Integrated Pest Management Specialist. Alan's just published a paper highlighting beneficial insects with lots of photos. Go to our website, check it out, nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Alan, right back to our listeners. Let's go to Jasmine in Winchester. Hi, Jasmine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. I so appreciate this topic. I think it is so important for people to understand the beneficials and to be able to recognize them. And at 50 years old, I have never in my entire life used any sort of chemical on my property, whether it's an herbicide, pesticide, or anything like that. And I find that if you let nature kind of take its course, everything is cyclical. And so while you might have a year of bad crickets or a bad year of bad Japanese beetles or a year of bad this or that, everything kind of works on its own. With the birds take care of things. You know, we have livestock, and we have, you know, with livestock comes flies. And I have a very healthy wasp population. And it just really kind of breaks my heart when I'm at the store and I see someone pulling, you know, a wasp killer off their shelf. And I'm thinking to myself, what are you doing?
Because, do you ever say anything?
You know, I have, but I have a hard time holding my tongue when it comes to things like that. So, you know, I don't want to really insult people. I mean, by the same token, educating people, you know, can take time. And I don't know. No, to answer your question, I have not said anything to people for the most part.
Yeah.
Just well, because it's a hard topic to kind of broach. You know,
it is.
People, and you know, why are you poisoning your backyard?
Well, and if you've got little kids and they're running around the backyard, you don't want a bunch of wasp nests, you know, where they run around. But I appreciate your call, Jasmine. What do you think, Alan?
I like her points. I also recognize, since I get lots of these calls myself, that there are some people that are really highly allergic to these things, and a sting can be life-threatening in a few cases. And in some cases, reaching for the sprayer, especially in the vicinity of schools and so forth, is a reaction to avoid being sued by an angry parent who says, you threaten my child by allowing them to get stung. So things like this, we're in a society where this lawsuit's thrown around all the time, and fear of these things, and in some cases serious medical reactions, allergic reactions.
Sure, some people are allergic
to bee
stings.
That. And so I can understand that. I really, Jasmine, I wish we had more people like you.
Well, let's talk about the pollinators, Alan, before we talk about anything else, because they are so important, and everybody understands, you know, the role they play in pollinating our crops so that we can eat, for heaven's sake. But there's a lot of worry about bees and other pollinators. What's the concern, Alan?
And first, let me say that when we talk about bees, many people think I mean honeybee. Honeybee is only one species. We've got something on the order of 200 species of bees in our state. So I'm not just meaning honeybee. Bees are the very best of the insect pollinators.
Why and, is that? Because they're fuzzy?
A number of reasons. Bees have exactly, they have branched hairs. And the branched hairs that they have, there's a photo of that in my publication, are extremely good at attracting and collecting pollen grains. So as a result, the pollen grains get attracted electrostatically to those branched hairs, and there aren't other forms of insects that have them. So that's one of the reasons. But they also have evolved good senses of flight, good senses of navigation, and they've got good vision and good smell. So they can find flowers, they can see flowers well, they can navigate back to their nests. So these all make them good pollinators.
What's the concern about bees in New Hampshire recently, Alan?
There's a number of concerns, and one of them is that as we continue to pave and plow and plant and spray higher and higher and higher percentages of our habitat, there's fewer and fewer and fewer places for these bees to forage for food, to nest, and to run their lives. And so as a result, it's important for us to start recognizing how many there are, what species they are, which ones are having problems, and then do what we can to provide them places to live and encourage their populations, not keep knocking them down.
Is it something as simple as just, you know, planting extra flowers?
To a degree, what's more important actually is to think about diversity. Because of the couple of hundred species we have, the bees vary tremendously in their length of tongue. Who would have thought that? So some flowers, like red clover, for example, is great for honeybees and great for bumblebees, most species, most of which have very, very long tongues. But for the short tongue species, they can't possibly reach the nectar in that species.
So they need a different type of flower.
So having a variety of species as flowers not only provides things for the long-tongued ones as well as the short-tongued ones, but also it has it so that we have something in bloom through the entire season.
So they have food for the whole season.
Because they have to, it doesn't do a great deal of good if they have a tremendous amount of food for 2 weeks and then nothing for the rest of the year. So understanding the diversity of plants that they need, not only for feeding, but then for habitat. Some of them are ground nesters. Some of them make hives. Some of them nest in cavities that are already like in plant stems or in existing holes made by borers. And so protecting the places that they live is important. Additionally, then, having a sensitivity about the way we use pesticides, for example, is another factor. And we try to get people to think before they, in fact, I've got a publication called Think Before You Buy a Pesticide. We want you to think about applying especially a chemical one. They're double-edged swords. They have positive effects and negative effects. And if you don't really need it, if there really isn't a positive need, then all you get are the negative effects. And understanding the ones especially that are highly toxic to the bees and understanding to avoid using them in a situation where they might be a problem is important. And also being sensitive about not spraying things that are insecticides on things that are in bloom. All of those can help reduce the negative effects on bees and help keep them going.
So here's a policy question. By the side of the road, the highways, you know, the grass grows up and sometimes wildflowers grow up. Maybe there's some, you know, just wildflowers and clover and whatever happens to grow there. And then it gets mowed. So because, you know, it seems, I don't know, messy or something. I mean, would it be better for New Hampshire DOT to just let it grow?
In fact, early on when they were starting to produce some of those patches, there were some embarrassing moments when the DOT or others mowed up pollinator patches. I think they're more sensitive to them now, and ones that have been specifically established for that purpose are allowed to get higher. And a lot, but they try to strike a balance of where it's important to keep it clear and where it's less important. So there's some places where it isn't a problem if it isn't mowed, and there are other places where it might be. So they're striking a balance between those two conflicting things.
Have you talked to folks over there about mowing and the importance of only mowing when necessary?
I have not myself, but others that are more into this area have. So no, I haven't.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange if you'd like. Alan, one more question about pollinators before we go back to our listeners and their questions. Everybody knows about the bees. You say in this publication, though, there are other sort of unsung hero pollinators. Who are they?
Well, there are some situations where other insects can move pollen around. In particular, there are some situations where it's just not very good habitat for bees. One area that I know about is the alpine garden on the top of Mount Washington, and many of these alpine plants are growing in situations where bees don't do very well, and there
it's
aren't very
too
many
cold
up there.
And foggy and windy,
and so it turns out that when the my colleague John Berger and others studied the what's going on and doing the pollination up there, they found it was flies. certain species of flies. And so there are some situations where other insects can take over the duties and provide some pollination, and that's an example of one where that happens.
So do wasps and hornets also pollinate to a lesser extent?
Yeah, they will. They'll move some, and many beetles will do the same. Some flies
beetles.
Will do the same. Yeah, some of them are especially abundant on flowers.
Now, that's interesting, because whenever we see beetles on our flowers, we get really upset.
but there are some that specialize on tumbling flower beetles and cerambycids and some other groups that are especially interested in collecting pollen and sometimes nectar. And so they're visiting a lot of these one after the other. They'll move some pollen around from flower to flower when they do that.
How do I tell which beetle is going to munch my flowers and which beetle is going to move pollen?
I think you make them fill out little surveys or something. other than that, you have to kind of know by recognizing the species of the group which ones are going to be bad and which one bad. Again, there I am saying the same thing, making the decision that they're going to be bad based on my values.
Let's take another call. This is Teresa in Durham. Hi, Teresa. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to share that the town of Durham has become the first Bee City USA town in the Northeast. And the Bee City USA is a national program to promote pollinators and pollinating habitat. So this is a new project that we've undertaken, the Durham Agricultural Commission, just to work with municipal staff and residents to raise awareness about the important role that pollinators, all different kinds, play in our community.
So and I've heard of Tree City, but you're a Bee City.
Yeah. Yep, and Durham is a tree city as well, and this is similar. It's a bee city, so there's no regulatory action or things involved. It was a resolution that the town council adopted at the urging of the Agricultural Commission just to support pollinators in town and on campus.
So what about, kind of sorry to interrupt, Teresa, what about roadside mowing?
And things like that, that's things that we're looking at as a community to see how that mowing and the application of certain things onto town-owned land, how that's going to be impacting pollinators. So it doesn't mean that we've enacted any specific policy yet, but it means that we are working to look at how we interact with that community as a town and to see if there are ways that we could make some changes so that we are more pollinator-friendly.
Handing out packets
of... With a lot of emphasis on residents, too, just educating residents about it.
So what's the number one thing that you find, Teresa, you know, residents not even realizing, but they're doing things that are not good for pollinators without even, you know, realizing they're doing it?
Right. Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've had that long discussion as a community, as many towns have in the region, about the use of nutrients and fertilizers and pesticides on our lawn in terms of nutrient loading into surface waters. But what we're finding is that often people are not aware that even if they're making the right choices in their own backyard, for example, not to apply certain chemicals that might harm pollinators, that when you go to purchase plants that you haven't grown yourselves, that often those are plants that have been pre-treated so that they're more resilient, you know, through that retail shopping experience, to they're more resilient to whatever those chemicals are, so that when the pollinators in your own backyard are then going to those plants, that they are and then picking up pollen that has had that treatment and taking it back to their hive.
And that could be
so
harmful?
So that's something I'm learning a lot. I'm learning just a lot myself as an Agricultural Commission member about things and mistakes I'm doing in my own yard. You know,
Teresa, real interesting, and hats off to Durham, a bee city, Alan. I had not heard of that.
Yes, I had heard that you were moving in that direction. Good for you, Teresa. It's good to see that the town has moved in having these kinds of discussions. Great job.
What about dragonflies, Alan? You talk a lot about those in the paper. You say they're great predators. They have excellent vision. They're quick-reacting, fast flyers. They can catch prey on the wing. What do you think most people don't understand about dragonflies?
I frequently get questions about dragonflies and where people can buy them so that they can introduce them to their own little pond or something or other. That's the most frequent question I
really?
Get about them.
So the fish will have something delicious to eat?
No, I think it's to try to control mosquitoes or something. And my answer usually is something like, I don't know where you could find somebody who could actually obtain the species you want that's unique for your exact situation, because each species lives in a different habitat, especially the immatures, and you'd have to pick the right species. And then where would you get them commercially? They're already here. There's some that feed in fast cold streams with rock bottoms. There's some that live in lakes and ponds with sandy bottoms. There's some that live in some of the spike tails that live in intermittent streams that dry up into mud areas in the summer. So we've got lots of different species that are here. Some of the species are annual. They have a one-year life cycle. Some of them have several years as immatures before they finally pop out as an adult. For the dragonflies, virtually all of our species, with the exception of maybe two of them, are daytime flyers. And the two I can think of that aren't are sort of crepuscular specialists.
Twilight.
Yes. And so they catch stuff on the wing. They're visual hunters. And they concentrate on whatever's out there.
Here's a question from Julian Stratum. She says, Alan, your beneficial insect guide is great. At 12 pages long, though, it's too long for the average gardener or farmer to take into the field every day. Can you recommend a shorter, perhaps photos-only publication that can go into a back pocket, or a website one can source on a smartphone that's more accessible in the field? And Julie, again, thanks you for all the great information.
Thank you, Julie. She's hit upon the problems that we faced in doing this, because photos alone, if you just use the photo without the descriptions that go with it, you might not identify stuff correctly. There are many insects that are really good at mimicry, and they can mimic something else. So I do not know of a source that hits what you're looking for, but more people are thinking about this, and perhaps someone will come up with something that is more smart, more mobile friendly that will do this.
Right, because if you're out on your farm, or we talked to a vintner earlier in his fields or just in your backyard, you want to just pull something out and say, Oh, this one's good. I'll leave it alone. Yeah,
so mine, not yet, but maybe someday.
Well, last question. One of our callers said that she absolutely hates ticks, and I'm thinking there are a lot of listeners who feel the same way. Are there any of these beneficial bugs that go after ticks?
There's a species of wasp that was introduced in, it's either Nashon or Nantucket a number of years ago. Many of us had great interest. It parasitizes ticks. But it turns out that it, once in a great while, will successfully find and kill one, and it just doesn't have a significant effect on the population. So we were disappointed to learn that. So around here, not too many.
Wow. Alan Eaton, thank you so much for being here. Again, go to our website to check out Alan's paper, see some pictures. We'll put some on Instagram as well. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.